हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनाभुनक्तु सहवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्त वृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे।
You know where we were up to? 10-4-3. Okay, gifts to be avoided.
Yeah.
Okay, so then here then you're talking about now the duties of a snatak, right? It means a graduated student, what as a married person he's going to do, how he's going to maintain himself, what etiquettes he's going to follow, how he's going to live. So then that means as a Brahmin he may be living by receiving gifts. So then what gifts should be avoided? So basically then it means those that are coming from sinful people, those should be avoided. Means we discussed that as if he may receive gifts that are from sinful people, but he has to use it for others that he's maintaining, for his gurus, give to the deities, give it away to others, like that. He can accept gifts from anyone, that he shouldn't refuse, like that. He can't refuse to take it, but he must give it away. The same time as then it concludes that if he is not, doesn't have any dependents, you know, doesn't have any guru, you know, who's living to render, to give money to, like this, then he should only live by accepting gifts from good people, like that, for his maintenance. In other words, if somebody comes who's not good, gives him money, he'll take it, but he'll just give it away to another Brahmin, like that, because he has no one. But otherwise, he himself, he shouldn't beg from anybody who is not proper, like that. Then study of the Vedas, then morning sadhana, then there's the yearly course of study. It means that in the Vedic study, then depends upon the Veda that you work by, then either the Purnima, like Balaram's Purnima, you know, when Balaram's appearance day, either from that Purnima, if it's Rig and Yajur and Atharva, or Samavedi start from the next Purnima, the one that's just after, Radhastami, like that. So either one of those, then they start the Vedic study. So then that means then they start seriously studying only Veda, and they do that up until Vasant Panchami. That means in a couple of weeks there'll be Vasant Panchami when spring starts. Then after that, from then until that time again the next year, then they do 2 weeks study of the Veda, 2 weeks study of other subjects. So they go back and forth. They don't only exclusively study the Veda then. Then the Adhyayana, circumstances of non-study, then basically there's so many technical rules, but we don't adhere to those because we're studying Veda for spiritual purpose, so they don't apply. Only the only ones that apply means that the atmosphere must be suitable to study, and it must be clean. Right? If the area is clean, you know, conducive for study, then it's done. But other things, other, you know, how you say, omens of the Adi Bhautik or Adi Daivik, then we don't bother with. Those aren't important. You know, if lightning comes or winds or this and that, then you can carry on studying if you're dealing with, you know, an atmosphere that's suitable. You know, if people become disturbed, there's no problem in stopping. But you don't have to stop. But in the Vedic, they have to stop. You know, if they're karmakandis, they must stop. They are obliged to. Like that. Because they're dealing for material benefit, and then the planets that control that material benefit and the deities of the directions that control all that, they're doing something. they're having a storm, they're creating different omens, so that has to be respected. But if one is working on the transcendental platform, then no need. It doesn't apply. And then, yeah. And personal behavior consonants, then he should always be celibate, unless he is planning to have children. Then he will maintain his Brahma Tejas. Then in bathing, walking, then he should be very careful when he's bathing, that it's not in a place he doesn't know. He shouldn't go like deep into a river or a pond that he doesn't know. He absolutely doesn't know it, he shouldn't really go too near it. You can go collect water, bathe on the bank. You know, because, you know, someone like Arjuna can go into the river, you know, into the lake, and if a big crocodile catches him, it doesn't matter. Then he'll wrestle with it, throw it on the bank. You know, it'll turn into an upsara. You know, like that. But generally, if we go in and the crocodile catches us, then we become lunch. You know, so therefore, one should be careful about those things like that. Then in walking, that he doesn't run when it's wet and slippery, because he can get hurt, so he doesn't have the right to create a situation of danger for a Brahmin like that. So he has to be careful when he walks or when he's traveling like that, that, you know, he travels only in safe situations like that. He wouldn't choose an unsafe situation. Let him not show particular attention to the wife of another man. As it mentions, there's nothing as sinful as paying too much attention to someone else's wife, because then that may turn into adultery. So adultery then causes mixed varnas and unqualified children, because you're supposed to marry a man and woman who are of equal nature. Then their children will be of good quality. But if you have an illicit relationship, then even if they are of similar nature, because it's illicit, then the child will not be pure. So they will always be a cause of disturbance. And many times is that adultery doesn't depend upon looking at equalness of nature. It's just mutual attraction. So you may get man and woman who are completely different in nature, but they have similar yoni. So then that will create attraction. Yoni meaning that I don't know how many kinds there are. 8, 10, 12 different categories of yoni by different animals. Yoni meaning the genitals. So then if there's a match in those, they have similar, then there'll be a natural sexual attraction. And if they're different or ones, then there'll be none like that. So, you know, like in marriage, it's one of the things that are checked, if there's a compatibility there. Because if there's not, then there'll be no children. So here is that may be compatible, so that's all one looks for if there's lust. So then you may get, you know, completely, you know, how you say, not very useful children out of it. So the Vedics, so then that's considered one of the worst things, because it's bad enough trying to maintain your principles just by in good association, let alone if you have people who are bad association or who are even opposing the Vedic principles like that. In that atmosphere, then it becomes even more difficult like that. So like that. So it's considered to be important that that's avoided. Then forbidden food. Then there's so much. Basic thing is that what is eaten should be pure. It should be what's offered to the deities or used in sacrifice. And it should be made of sattvic things. So it mentions that onions, garlics, leeks, and mushrooms. We skipped a page. Oh. So then, our pages are out of order. Okay. 92, 9, wow, 574. Okay. Let him never despise a Kshatriya, a snake, and a learned Brahmin, even if they are weak. Because any one of them, if offended, can destroy you. Even if they're weak today, it doesn't mean that they won't get you tomorrow. Like that. A perfect example in our experience is Chanakya Pandit. You know, physically he wasn't weak. You know, I think he was even a bit, you know, difficulty in walking and that. So he looked very funny. He was not very attractive Brahmin. By Lakshana, he was not attractive. Therefore, he was insulted by Maharaj Nanda. So then, because Chanakya was expert in the political field, then he understood that this king is not qualified to rule. So he decided he is going to see to the removal of the king. Also knowing the political field so well and the shastras on that, he knew how the palace is built, so he knew how to escape out of all the secret, you know, places and all that. So then he escaped before the king could catch him, because the king insulted Chanakya. Chanakya pronounced in front of everybody that he will see that he's removed from his position. So the king got, you know, displeased, and, you know, told his men to catch him and kill him. So he escaped. And in this way, then first of all, he found someone suitable, because he knows no use getting rid of the king if you don't replace him. Right? Because a bad king's better than no king. Because at least then there's some law and order. Maybe he's exploitive, but if he's not too exploitive, at least there'll be some law and order, and the people in general will be a little peaceful. So he found Chandragupta, and then after finding him and training him, then through his political means, then when Chandragupta was ready to take over, then he had the king killed, and then Chandragupta came in and took over the kingdom. Took him 8 years, but he did it. Like that. So that's the point, is never offend these. You know, Kshatriya, he may be small today, but by some fortune, he becomes big tomorrow. You know, like you meet the Pandavas in the forest, you may think, ah, the small kings have been thrown out, and if they're offended, but later on they're the emperors. You know, so you don't want to bother Kshatriyas. And snakes, that's pretty obvious, because snakes aren't stupid. Like that, they can identify people. They can tell the difference. It's not just that, you know, it's like, you know, how you say, you know, it's typical is that you go to a new place, you can't tell anyone apart. They all look the same, like that. So snakes aren't like that. They can tell who you are, and if they decide they're going to get you, they'll follow you. There's been stories of them following people hundreds and hundreds of miles. So like that. So therefore, never offend these three. Let him not despise himself on account of failure. This is a very important point, is that this doesn't mean we're not sensitive to failure, but one doesn't despise oneself. Because the point is we're not the doer. And at the same time, is if something's not gone right, then it's just a matter of doing it right. There's no need to get mental about it. You've done it wrong, then you figure out how to do it right and just do it right. You just move on. To despise yourself means that you feel that you are special, so you should have done great, and you didn't get great, therefore people blame you, and which is not what you should be. You should be praised, not blamed. So then you despise yourself for having put yourself in this position. But if one's humble, then one moves on. Okay, something went wrong. Okay, people make complaints. Okay, what's right? Just do it right. If you do it right, people won't complain. Like that. At least honest people won't. Dishonest, then they'll always say, you know, like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur gives the example of the naked mother. You know, she was naked when she was a little girl, 5 years old, running around naked. But now she's grown and married and has children. She doesn't run around naked. But the tendency is, oh, I knew her when she was just little girl running around naked. She can't be anything, you know, together, organized or that. She, you know, like this. So that principle one has to be careful of is that kind of person. It doesn't matter anyway. No matter what you do, it'll be seen badly. You know, even if you do something very wonderful, they'll find some fault in it, like that. So those kind of persons you can't take seriously, and those who are honest, then they'll see you do it right. It's accepted that way. You know, if it's done right, the mentality is right, it'll be accepted. So therefore, the principle is that you've done something wrong, figure out what's correct way to do it, and just do it. Don't get mental about it. That's the Brahminical platform. Otherwise, getting mental is passion and ignorance. Ignorance is that you think you're the doer. Passion is that you lost your prestige due to it not being performed properly. Then appropriate speech, then he should always speak, be careful in his speaking, that he uses the proper speech for whatever the situation is. It's not that, he's talking to someone senior, he speaks appropriately, someone junior, he speaks appropriately, someone equal, he speaks appropriately. Someone not educated, you speak appropriately, someone educated, like this, you have to know who you're speaking to and speak appropriately. Otherwise, then they'll feel that you're not actually communicating with them. Care and travel, then we mentioned that before. You see that it's not difficult. Let him not insult others. It means because of some fault, some physical fault or mental or intellectual fault, then it shouldn't be something mentioned, or birth or anything like this. These shouldn't be used like that. Care while impure, when he's impure, that he should be careful he doesn't touch things that are pure. Like he's impure, he doesn't touch, pure water, pure fire, pure these kind of things. He should purify himself before touching any of these things. Because otherwise, if they become impure, then how do you purify yourself? Yes.
In times of urgency or emergency, if we are impure, and then let's say we get out of bed and we have to give some medicine or something to someone, and we haven't taken bath, so can we just chant Hare Krishna and expect?
Can, but you can wash your hands also.
Yes, of course. But if even that is not possible, so
you can, but generally see is like, if these things are important for you, then there'll always be places where water and stuff like that are.
Yeah.
Because then you instead of keeping your tilak in the bathroom, you have an ashraman cup and stuff outside. So there's always something there, or something in different places, or you have your altar, so there's different points of where water is for purifying.
Yeah.
So that's important, then generally you have. And then if you absolutely can't do that, but generally you'll find most situations, even in emergency, that little bit you can do, like that. But at the same time,
if you wash your hands, then you are somehow pure enough.
It's better than not washing them at all.
Yes.
In other words, you find what's the closest you can get to the standard in an emergency.
Okay.
That's the thing, is you know what is the standard. You always try to attain the standard, but sometimes you can't. So you pick the closest thing possible to it. So that's the proper application of the law when it comes to ideal and not ideal situations. When it's ideal, then it should be followed properly. And when it's not ideal, you get as close as you can, like that. And so there's no fault in that. If you just get as close as you can, that will be accepted. But if you can get closer and you choose a lesser one due to laziness, then that's motive passion, giving up the duties because it's difficult. So that's not seen as good, because that passion will then lead to ignorance. So one will degrade. But if one is, for the situation, doing one's best, then that's accepted as good enough. Like that.
Huh. Talking about impurity, when the ladies, three days months,
mm-hmm.
Long time before the ladies they get separated, and the ladies in the household, but nowadays it's just that husband and wife stay in the house, and sometimes the husband don't know to cook, or they don't cook, or they don't have time to cook.
Well, it's a way to teach them how to cook, isn't it? It's like they cook or they starve. It's pretty good.
But it's still considered that, shouldn't it?
If one can avoid that, it's good. Like that. I've seen devotees here in Mayapur, traditional backgrounds, and they won't touch the fridge, won't go into the kitchen, won't go, certain places they'll move, and the rest of the times they won't, Because then it's also, it means it depends how you look at it, to be inspired or not, is that here's every month a 3-day paid holiday, like that. Traditional families, and the men cook, they do all the things, they clean the house and that, and women just sit back and relax. Rest, because it's pretty full on, their schedule. So then they can take extra rest. They have reading to do. They can do. They want to do whatever they want to do. They can do. Then the men do the cooking. They do everything. So they're just taken care of. So you know, you can always, if one is following that standard, then the men would figure out pretty quick how to do some cooking. What does it take to cook? Prabhupada said every brahmachari should know how to cook. And Grihastha is supposed to have been a brahmachari beforehand, so at least they should be able to do something simple. If not, they can learn. You know, they can expand their horizons. Like that, like that. And at the same time, is then it makes it that, you know, there's that appreciation, is that they know what the other side is doing. Because if they have to clean the house, wash the clothes, do the cooking, you know, then they start to see what's actually going on in the house. You know, same time as, you know, it goes the other way, is that because they can do it, then there's the natural respect from the women, is that they can do what we're doing. So it's not that we're only doing it and they can't. So it develops respect from both sides. So it's depends on how you, and everything's how you look at it. You know, you can take this something very nice, and just by choosing a different synonym, then you can change the connotation to something bad. You know, like that. Yeah. It's that, you know, like that. Someone's an independent thinker. He's rebellious. You know, it's the same thing. You know, or he's malcontent. All it is he questions. So it all depends upon, one is their attitude, of course, but you can take something that may be one thing and by the name turn it into another. So one should always be very, very careful and see, the Vedas have it like that for a reason. It means the whole idea is that the Vedas are not trying to punish women, it's just that they have a mentality, and by these traditions, then it's actually pleasing to them. So they get a break. You know, that's the whole idea, is that there's, you know, they can just go sit, think, rest, get into their head like that, and then it's very nice. They just get away from it. But it means you go to these holiday resorts around the world and it's just full of men, right? Right? You go to all these, you go to the French Riviera, you go to the Bahamas, you go to Koh Samui, you go to, you know, Bondi Beach. There's only men there, right? They're the only ones that need holidays, right? No, it's full of women, right? And there are men there, but why are those men there? Because the men want the women want to go there, and they take the man along with them. You understand? Otherwise, men don't go on that kind of holiday, right? You know, they don't go to where there's some nice, comfortable arrangement that others are taking care, right? You go to a spa. What's nice about that? Instead of putting the oil on yourself, someone else does it for you. You know, you go to the restaurant. Someone else cooks and serves you. Right? So instead of having to go out, this is what happens in your own house. You know? So that's the difference. But by semantics, you can take it and turn it around and look like it, make it look very bad. You know? But you save a lot of money. Right? Isn't it? You know, it's like, it means that's basically speaking 1 month a year holiday. Right? You know, so it's just a matter of how it's looked at. That's the point. So the Vedas are doing it because it fits the nature, not that it goes against. Dharma means it fits the nature. Adharma means it goes against the nature. So if there's a rule, that means that rule is there to ensure that the nature is maintained properly. Like that. Does that make sense? So that's the yes.
Just had a question about when we brought up in the men's
It gets down to that. It would, yeah.
Because they probably wouldn't think about that.
No, they definitely have a tendency to not think about that. That's why the boys need to go to Gurukul, because otherwise they have no idea why things work in a house. That there's some mystic potency that the mother has, that the jar is always full of cookies and the food is always there, and it just mystically happens. They have no idea because they're out playing all day, so they just run into the house and there's something to eat and they run out of the house, and then some mystically something else happens, you know, like that. You know, it's like, but they never stop to think. That's why they have to go to Gurukul. As they have, then they have to learn to do them all themselves. So one that they can do that, then the women will respect them for that. It maintains their independence. At the same time, it's then they can appreciate what service the wife is rendering, because they know what it is. Like, you know, I was in one house, big things. Yeah. Well, you know, we're having guests over. We'll cook this. You know, like that. And the wife is saying yes. You know, and how much time you need for that? You know, and so we need this much time. Why do you need so much time? You know, that's just, you know, you just go in, you boil some water, you throw this in here, stir that around, and it's ready. You know, it's as ready as quick as the guy says it. The wife says, not quite like that. And he's arguing like anything. And the point is, you know, he couldn't cook to save his life. You know? So that's the problem. So then, you know, the women won't say that, but then someone else has to say it. So that's the point. So they should know all these things. Yeah, it can be brought up. Could you close this? Yeah, the windows. And that. You're fine. Eagerly following auspicious customs and the rule of good conduct means is that one should look at them, understand them, and then understanding them, then eagerly follow them. Like that. So one should follow the rule of good conduct. One should avoid what conduct is not good. But eagerness means that it shouldn't be artificial. It should be because one understands that this is good. So one should have that understanding. So that's the whole idea, is to question, to ask. So it's a symptom of human life, is to ask. But at the same time, of course, there's the etiquette in asking, you know, in a way to understand, like that. Because the point is this, any explanation, then it's being, principles are being pointed out, and a detail is given to show the example or application. But if one fully understands the principle, then it's okay. But if one doesn't, then one will naturally in one's mind try to apply it in one's own life. One will come up against something he doesn't understand. So then it will create a doubt. So then it's a matter, okay, how to apply it in this situation. Rather than find a doubt and then leave it and drop it. Does that make some sense? That makes sense? Like that. So the whole point is one should be inquisitive, one should want to know, one should question, but with the purpose of getting an answer that you can apply, rather than get an answer that you want to not apply it. Does that make sense? Like that. That's the whole principle. Okay. Then the primary duty then is one should there are principles that always have to be followed, the primary duties that one has to do. Then there's secondary duties. So one should always follow the primary, and the secondary may or may not apply according to time, place, and circumstance. The primary always does. But then if one follows the secondary always, but not necessarily the primary, then that's considered bad. That's not accepted as proper. So one is dutiful means one always follows the primary duties. What is the actual essential points? You know, just like the Brahmin studies and teaches, you know, like this. So that has to be going on, though some other secondary things may not be necessarily. You know, he wasn't able to say Achman at this time or something like that. But if he always says Achman but never studies, then that won't be seen as good. Or Kshatriya, he has to protect the people. If he doesn't protect them but he follows some other things, he takes, you know, some other means, then that will be seen as bad. You know, so the primary always has to be followed. And far from his dwelling, let him remove impurities. So whatever impurities are there in the house, then they should not just sit outside the house. Don't throw the garbage right out the window or something. You know, it has to go some distance when one will not be affected by the impurities caused by that impurity. you know, and within the house see that the impurities are kept, you know, in certain places, you know, like that. Respecting the deities, Brahmins, king, and his gurus. So then, on a daily basis, then the deities, the Brahmins, you know, his gurus should be respected. And if one bumps into administrators, then they must be respected. You know, this is proper conduct. Then reverence towards venerable guests. So they must always be taken care of. You know, because when guests come, then when they come, then if they're respected, then you get benefit. And if they're not respected, then when they leave your house, they take with them all your good merit. You know, it means if you take care of them, you get the merit of taking care of them and something from them. But if you don't take care of them or ignore them, then when they leave the house, they take with them all your good qualities, because they have to have benefited by coming to your house. So it's either you consciously give benefit, or they take your inherent benefit with them. Same in a sacrifice. Brahman does a sacrifice. Then if at the end, then he's taken care of, he's given dakshin, then the benefit of the sacrifice goes to the person who held the sacrifice. Otherwise, the Brahmins aren't given dakshin, then the performance of the sacrifice, the benefits, goes to the person who performed it. Right? Does that make sense? Means you want to do a sacrifice, but you bring a Brahmin to do it for you. So the point is the person who does the sacrifice gets the benefit. Whoever sits there and does the sacrifice gets the benefit. So when you give the dakshin to the Brahmin, then the benefit that he got from doing your sacrifice goes to you. Like that. You don't give dakshin, he walks out with it. So does that make some sense? So many, many times you see devotees say, "Oh, we're devotees, we don't care for that." But it's just the way it works. You know, so if I take the prasad and put it on your plate and you eat it, you get it. It doesn't come to me. It's not a matter of, "Hey, I'm a devotee, why didn't I get it?" No, he did the work. You know, it's just the way the mechanics function.
Like, yeah.
Like that. No, because we've gotten the knowledge, but to be able to maintain using the knowledge, then that's there. Because it's just part of the etiquette. We've benefited because because it's longer term. It means the point is we're benefiting, just like we're benefiting in a sacrifice. We're hearing it, we're being purified by it, but there's also the overall benefit that comes from it. Like you have the sacrifice, hearing the mantras, you know, things that are going on, you're getting benefit from that association. But then there's the ultimate benefit specifically that comes from that. So knowledge, we're getting benefit, but then knowing that body of knowledge and being able to apply it is the overall benefit. So then, therefore, it becomes part of the process. Like that. But it's not that we're not benefiting as it goes on. Does that make some sense? Because like in the Gurukul, those who go to the Gurukul, then they don't give any dakshin while they're in the school, only when they leave the school. Mm-hmm. Like that. But like a Naistika doesn't give any, because his service is what is being rendered. But when he stops that, then the dakshin is given. Because Brahmins don't do things because they're paid. That's the principle. They do things because it's their duty. And then others want to support, nice, they don't want to support, they still do their duty. Like that, they'll get the benefit. That makes some sense. So that's the actual independence of Brahmins. Like that. That's the meaning of they don't depend upon others. They just do their duty and they depend upon their duty. You know? They perform Dharma. Dharma protects them. Like that. Dharma rakshita rakshataha, something like that. You protect Dharma, Dharma protects you. So they function on that. So therefore they're independent of everybody because of that. You pay them, don't pay them, but they go on. They'll do their brahminical activities. You won't get any benefit, but they'll do their whatever they're doing anyway. Like that. while others actually are dependent. Like that. Kshatriya is dependent upon the tax, Vaishya is dependent upon that protection to run his business.
So Brahman, like someone who practicing the activities of Brahman, learning and teaching, but who thinks that he wants to have enough to survive in terms of oppression, and who thinks he has to go and collect, it means he doesn't have enough faith in
it depends on the situation, depends upon how many people and this and that. It just, there is that element, but it should be natural. So if they can function on that, then it is there. But then there's more to it than that, is that you have the element of he has his family members. So what they expect also. You know, it's like maybe he can live without anything, but whether the rest of the family can agree to that also. Because that's the thing, and no one says that every day is going to be great, you know, when you live in that kind of fashion. If you live by these methods, Rita Amrita or Rita, I said Rita Amrita or Amrita, by begging, by receiving just whatever anyone gives or gleaning from the fields, then it's not always regular. You know, you hear all the time of Brahmins, they have nothing. But they just go on, because if they're supposed to have something, they'll get. And if they don't, if they're not supposed to have anything, if they even they endeavor hard, they won't get. So, like that. So you also have to see if the family members are of the same nature. And if they're not, they feel the need to do, then they do. It keeps them engaged. Main thing is to keep them engaged. And they shouldn't be in anxiety. So, there's no use in teaching for 12 months a year and then being anxiety for 12 months. And if they, you know, teach for 8 months and go out and collect for 4, and then they're nicely situated for 8 months, and they're getting that 8 months of benefit. So like that, you have to see the individual. You know, it depends upon. And if they're nicely situated, whatever level it is, then with time they'll become purified, and that will, they'll adjust. You know, because generally it's Rita or Mrita are recommended, not Amrita. Like that. Because Amrita may end up in laziness. So to see that there won't be laziness, then generally Rita or Mrita are recommended. That means gleaning or begging are recommended, like that. If he wants to follow that, then more than that, he just follows. He just teaches, you know, like that. But then some of them teach because they're going to get a return from it, or he can do sacrifices and other things and take what comes from that, you know, or do puja and stuff for others. You know, so he can just decide if he wants to live by those occupational. In other words, he lives by occupational duties. Which means by teaching, by performing puja, or receiving charity, like that. Or he can take up these other ones. So it's all, the Brahmins have probably the greatest scope of how they could economically take care of themselves. Each one on their own is not, you know, you're not going to become fabulously wealthy unless you do, you know.
Yeah.
That's why education was left to Brahmins, because they're doing it because they have the knowledge and they will teach it to those who are qualified. While the business person will run it for whoever's got money, like that. So it's very rare you have an institution that will go by qualification rather than money, like that. You know, if it's run by vices. They'll always just, they got money, they'll take them. And they know what money people want, so they'll create the facilities like that. You know. So that's why it's a brahminical activity. Because then they'll do it because it needs to be done. And that, and people pay for it, nice. People don't pay for it, you know, they'll go on. Like that. Yeah, following the conduct of virtuous men, so they take example of others who are of good conduct and follow their example, you know, their teachings, their like that, following the footsteps of those who are virtuous. Right, so you can see there also is that all these have, these are, like we're reading it here in the mentality, the mood is that of Dharma Shastra, but actually you go up in here, virtuous, following the conduct of virtuous men means the previous acharyas, so following the example set down by, you know, so we have that also, that principle is following the footsteps of the great personalities. So all those, the primary duty, right? So then to be Krishna conscious, to perform one's devotional activity, that's the primary duty. Secondary duty then means our social and economic, you know, activities. Like that, following auspicious customs, the rule of good conduct means the devotional principle. So you can take each one of these and put it into the devotional conduct. So we've always heard like that. Problem is devotees don't know how to translate it into this level. So then they say, I have my Krishna consciousness, and then I have, you know, the realities of life. Point is that realities of life are only based on the devotional principles. When you reflect the spiritual world is only devotional principles. So that means the material world is a reflection of that. So the way it works is the same. Point is in the spiritual world they're conscious of God, and in the material world they're not. So then, on the top level, you see the philosophy and the culture coming from that. So you don't see there is no real difference for you in the philosophy and in the economics. But for those who can't catch that connection, then philosophy is counted as one subject, economics is counted as another. Right? And then religion is counted as another, sense gratification is another, liberation is another. But for the devotee, it's all one thing. Right? You perform your religious duties of worshiping the Lord, right? So right there you've done two, right? You've done Dharma and Bhakti, you know? From that you'll get your economic development, right? And then from people give you donations, like that. From that, then you're taking prasad, your senses are taken care of. By taking prasad, you're freed from all material contamination. There's your liberation. And it situates you in bhakti. Right? Does that make some sense? So everything's taken care of. It's already included. But if you can't see it, then the shastras give all the mundane aspects. Okay, what is dharma, artha, kama, and moksha? So then you're able to go into that. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's the reason that these classes are being done in this way, is so that it's understood that it's the same thing. You just have to know how to translate it. You know, like that. So generally that's what happens. Devotees don't know how to translate the spiritual into the spiritual culture, and the spiritual culture already contains dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. So then they separately go out and go buy how to do it books, you know, from, you know, off the shelf or at the airport and like this, and then they educate themselves. When the Vedas already explain all that. It's already been explained. So this particular approach then if you don't see it in the devotional light, has a bit of a, you know, it has a mundane flavor. It's a pious mundane flavor. You know, it's a cultured mundane flavor, but mundane nonetheless. But if you see it in connection with Krishna, then it becomes spiritualized. But the point is one may say it's mundane, but, you know, you're not paying your electricity bill. What's so spiritual about that? You know, is it written on pages of Bhagavatam, right? You know what I'm saying? So that's, and what are you paying with? You're paying with rupees. Anything spiritual there? You know, like that. You're throwing out your garbage. What's spiritual about that? You're cleaning your toilet. What's spiritual about that? So that's the thing, is the Vedas teach you how to make that spiritual. Right here, you throw out your garbage. Every day you throw out your garbage. Right? But here, throw the garbage out so it's not close to your house. So it's not going to create smells and things that's going to bother your house. So right there, just walking out and seeing that you get it in the garbage can or don't throw it too close, then you've already spiritualized. You're throwing out your garbage. Right? That's the point. Is there is no mundane religious system or book that will teach you how to do this. Only the Vedic culture can teach you. So that's why Prabhupada recommends the Vedic culture, because there's no aspect of it that is not connected with God. How you cut your nails, how you brush your teeth, you know, what clothes you wear, how you keep your hair. It's all shown how you can Krishnaize it and actually get spiritual benefit from it. It's indirect, it's not direct devotional service like chanting and all that. But the point is it's dealing with the material body, and you're going to do it anyway. That's the point. Anyone who's conditioned is going to do it anyway. So statements like, oh, we don't care for all this stuff, we're devotees, doesn't mean anything, because they're doing it anyway. In the same breath they say, we don't care, they're doing it. Does that make sense? The point is the person saying, I don't care, is making money. Unless they're living full time in the temple and not bothering with them. They say that, then you can say, yes, they don't care. But if they're not living like that, they care. Because they're making economics. They're endeavoring for sense gratification. Right? They have their way, they've worked out their religion, you know? Like that, the religion of their house, okay? The broom goes here, and, you know, the cane furniture goes here, and the picture of Krishna goes over here, and the, you know, Rajasthani print curtains go here, and, you know, it's like that. You know, your little incense holder goes here. You know, you go. Every house, they have their religion where it goes. So that's the whole point. They will make their own religion. Like that. So the point is, but you get no benefit from it. You get no actual religious benefit, because it's not actually in line with the real religion of it. Like that. So then here is a method how you're going to connect it. But the trick is you can't replace your mundane non-Vedic with mundane Vedic. You have to apply the Vedic with the devotional attitude. Then it has a benefit. Otherwise, then it's nice, it's pious, but, you know, there's already, you know, enough people who just follow the Vedic principles without knowing the philosophy, right? We don't need more. Prabhupada was not trying to expand followers of the Veda who weren't devotees, like that. So the point is, being devotees, and since we have the mundane aspects of our life, engage them in Krishna's service through the Vedic principles. Does that make some sense? Or? Self-reliance. Avoiding undertakings which depend on others means as much as possible, then, unless that is one's position. If one's taking a position of dependence on others, and from that then you do, like, you know, the wife will be on the husband or on the son or like this. So that's a position of dependence. So that's just inherent in it. But otherwise, the other economic, then you have to decide whether you want to take that. So here it's saying because it's talking about a snatic, so specifically talking from the Brahminical point of view. And then from there, then you adjust it for whatever is one's position. Brahman should be independent. What you do yourself makes you happy. What you depend on others do makes you unhappy. Right? So it's not that, oh, you know, dependent on them, they didn't come through, or they didn't show up, or they were late, or they didn't do it, or they didn't do a good job, like that. That all makes you unhappy. So that's the Vedic definition. It says, in short, of happiness and distress. Happiness is doing it yourself. Unhappiness is depending upon someone else to do it for you. It means, what is your duty? It means, if it's your duty to do it yourself. Don't get someone else to do it. Like, if it's your duty to wash your clothes, you doing it, you'll be happy. Right? You get someone else to wash it, they won't wash it up to your standard or in the way you want it. You'll be unhappy. Right? This doesn't mean that where you have duties, you don't do them because you're not independent. It means everybody's, you know, means the wife may be dependent on the husband, but when it comes to washing the clothes, she's supremely independent. Right? You know, she can herself put the soap in the machine and push the button herself. You know, as soon as you ask someone else to do it, then it doesn't work. You know, there's always something, they always push the wrong buttons, right? You know, your delicate stuff they put on full wash. You know, so then you become unhappy. You know, your nice new sweater comes out, you know, it'll fit the local cat because they use hot water instead of cold. You know, like that. So that's why it's, everybody has the position that they are independent. So then you apply it there. Does that make some sense? So that's the thing. It shouldn't be used to meaning I should be independent and you know, socially free from everybody. You can if you want to be an avatut. But then you go to the forest, you know, like that. Then you can be independent as you like. No one cares. But if you're going to function in the social system, one has to fit where one naturally fits, and at the same time within performance of one's own duties, then be independent that you do it, you get it done yourself. What you're supposed to do, you don't depend on someone else to do your work. Does that make sense? That's the meaning.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the short definition of pleasure and pain. You know, doing it yourself, you're happy. Letting someone else do it, you're always unhappy. Right? Isn't it? If you want to do get something done right, do it yourself. Right? That's yeah.
What if you're always happy when someone else is doing it?
Well, then that'll work if it's your duty to get someone else to do it. You know, like that. Your duty to get someone else to do it. You're supposed to delegate responsibility or things and that. Then you're happy. You know, you have your man. They take care of the garden. Then because that's your duty to get him to do it. But if you get someone else to take care that he takes care of the garden, then they won't do the garden the way you want, and then you're unhappy. Like that. So there's still you're getting the person to do what is there. So that's the whole point. It means anything that's your duty. Then, if you do it, then you're happy. And if you don't, if you let others do it, then you won't be happy. You know, unless, does that make sense? Nonviolence by body, mind, and words. So, what you speak shouldn't hurt others. What you think shouldn't be, you know, violent. Because if you think violence, then it'll come out in some way, either physical or verbal. Is violence, and physically, one shouldn't do violence. It says, a wise man should never threaten a Brahmin, because they means if you physically attack a Brahmin or something, even just speaking bad words, you get a reaction. But if you actually physically attack him, then that's worse than if you actually draw blood, then you really got a problem. Because when you draw blood, then it's counted in grains of dust that one drop, you know, for how much grains of dust become soaked up in the blood for that many years, then you will suffer. Like that. And one knows how fine a grain. So one drop of blood will soak up, could be hundreds of grains of dust. So that's why one avoids, you know, they may be driving you nuts, but you don't bang them over the head with a bamboo. Like that. Like that, because the Brahminical culture, the whole thing is on the knowledge that you gain how to live and how why you're doing it. So it's so important that those who are doing that are, even if they may have sometimes bad qualities, it's still left, because the what they're doing is so much more important. You know, like you see the Brahmins, Vena was the king. He was a bad person, but in the beginning, at least he did the duties of a king properly. Though he himself was a bad man. But then when his badness influenced his duties, so he wasn't even doing the duties of a king properly, then they removed him. So if the person may be a bad character but a good teacher, then it's left. But as soon as then the teaching goes down, then they're not performing Brahminical duties, then they're removed from it. Does that make sense?
Isn't it inevitable?
Yeah, but at the time when it's still working, you leave it. You know, maybe it'll take 10 years, but for 10 years, then they're not bothered. But when that 10th year comes, then at that time, then they may be either, you know, corrected, and if they'll reform, nice, and if they don't, then they have to change duties like that, because they have to be performing. The king's business is to see that everybody in the Varnashram system is following the duties they say that they're doing. If he claims to be a Brahmin, he has to be doing Brahminical duties like that. If he's not, if he's doing another duty, then he has to then change and call himself by that, you know. So like that. So it's like, let us say he's doing education, but he's doing it as business. So then he'll be says, you either have to run this as education or you go do business, but not make a business out of education. Like that. So like that it would be seen. Someone claims to be a Kshatriya, but they're not. They're using the tax for themselves. That means they're a landlord. So they're a Vaishya. Like that. So they have to choose a position, you know, or they're just an actor. So then they have to then say, okay, now you're an actor. You know, you're not from the other. So you have to see what is the actual purpose behind. You know, someone may have a drama troupe, but from that they're making money. You know, that's what they organize. So they're actually a Vaishya, they're not an actor. But the guys that work with them, he just pays them. They're actors. Even though he may go on the stage. Does that make some sense? So you have to see what's the mentality behind each person. You know? Means that for the artist, it's expression that's important. Expression, recognition, fame. But for the business person, it's the money. Right? You know, after the performance, then the people are clapping. For the artist, it means they appreciated what was done. The expression was good that they appreciated. For the business person, he's in ecstasy that they're clapping, because that means then they'll come back or they'll tell their friends and they'll get more money. Right? So it's just a matter of what they're getting from it that makes the difference. The people are protected. That makes the Kshatriya happy. Not that he's getting the tax. That's the secondary. By tax, he will run his administration that the people can be protected. Right? But the zamindar, he protects the people so he can get the tax. So that it looks exactly the same. A Kshatriya king and a Vaishya king look the same. Externally. They'll have their court, they'll do all the things, they'll take care of this. But one is doing it, he's protecting to get money, one is getting money so he can protect. Like that. You know, it's like you have the East India Company. Right? It looks like a Kshatriya organization. They go out with their cannons and fight, but it's only business. They go in to fight so they can get money. Well, a Kshatriya gets money so he can raise an army so he can fight to protect the people. So it's just that they were very, you know, very, how do you say it? Aggressive businessmen. That's all. That's all. But it was purely business. It was a business. Then at one point when they got out of hand because they don't have any standards, then the crown had to step in, and then they took over India. Otherwise, East India Company was just a private business that managed India for money. That's all. It was just a big business. Managing India was just a business. Like that. So it means they took tax, but they were taking tax for business. So then when they got out of hand and they couldn't properly protect the people so that their religious sentiments and that weren't being recognized and it created revolt, then the crown had to step in and nationalize the business, and so then it became a an administration under the crown. So then they took the tax, but so that they could run the place. So, yes.
In Vaishnava culture, we are supposed to beg forgiveness for any offenses even like performed in terms of words or mind.
Can, if you think it's a benefit, if it will help, but it's not necessary. If you figure it's either too delicate or by saying it'll create worse, mm-hmm. then don't. Then you have to do something for it by chanting and all that. You have to correct the mentality. So in other words, you feel bad about it. You know why it's not good. And that remorse then will create the purification. But if it's actually come out of the mouth in speech or with the body, then because that's known. In other words, what's known, then there must be a correction for what's unknown, nobody knows about, then is taken care of by chanting, studying, sadhana, these kind of things.
If one has been committing an offense for someone by speaking about that person to someone else in a derogatory way, then we should, as Brahmanas, we should be straightforward and truthful.
Mm-hmm.
But if we go to the person, that person we have been offending, and we tell them, you see, I'm coming to apologize to you because I have actually offended you by speaking untrue words about you. And then that creates in itself violence to the person who will have to hear it in turn,
mm-hmm.
himself, right?
It means you have to judge whether that's important or not. But to the person that you've been speaking badly with about the third party, means the second party that you've been talking about and offending the third party, to them you should say something. Because that's the form in which the offense is actually made. So in that form you have to tell them that actually you're wrong. You know? Because then it'll change the whole environment.
So there's no need to work with that.
Not necessarily, but if they find out about it, then yes. But if they don't, then you have to judge. I mean, so in other words, you have to judge whether it's beneficial or not, because sometimes it may make them mental, you know, like that. May not, but you have to see who the particular individual. The main thing is tell that other person that it's not good, and then don't do it again. And if you don't have the opportunity to tell that other person, then you have to just yourself understand it's not good, and then see that you don't do it. You know, increase your spiritual activities so that you become purified, so that that's avoided.
You know, sometimes in community Vaishnavas, rumors get carried around, and they turn out to be untrue. And
yeah, no, they're quite amazing.
We know they are untrue. We ourselves propounded them. So,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, it's called I think most people, yeah, the grapevine. They also, it's a thing called Chinese whispers. You know, I don't know. People call it different things. You know, so I think it's always what grade do they do that? I think the fifth grade, you know, exercise. You know, the whole class, 30 students sit in a circle, and then the first one writes something down, folds it up, and gives it to the person on on the left. Then they say what is on the paper to the person on the right.
Mm-hmm.
Then they say it to the next. It goes all the way. So it goes around 30 people, and then the last person says what they have heard, and then reads what's on the paper. And they're generally, they can be 180 degrees. So that's rumors. That's why Lord Chaitanya tells Raghunath Das, don't get involved in Gramya Katha, because you can never tell what's been said. You know, it changes, you know, from somebody heard it, you know, and then because a bunch of people heard it, then you say everybody's talking about it, so it must be valid. But it all started from one person. Like, I remember, I forget who it was.
Yeah,
the donkey one. I also heard of this in Vrindavan. Someone's just telling me about this last year, that something was coming up, and they were discussing something about this one devotee was discussing with this other devotee about maybe something they had heard or like that, or this person was known for having done, and everybody, well, there's so many people in the movement would think that this person has done this thing, and they were, and so the first party was talking to the second, and I'm not sure that they weren't apologizing about it. And then there was a third person there who was just observing, spoke up and says, no, hey, you can't apologize for that. I started that rumor. Like that. You know, they specifically started it on purpose to give the guy a bad name. He says, I started that. So you can't claim you did it. And then it got into the whole thing of why he did that. And this is something going back like into, I don't know, the early 70s or something like that. And it had been floating around and only got like cleared from the air just like a year or two ago. It was some far out thing that sometimes people would even start things just to, because they knew it would create problem. You know, it was kind of funny how it came out. It was kind of funny. You know, everybody was laughing about it, but it was you know, it was really funny how it came up, because they had heard from somebody and then they thought somebody had just mentioned it to them, the fact, and then they told somebody who made it known around the world, and they felt sorry for having done that. And then the other party says, hey, you can't get the credit for spreading around the world. I spread it around the world. You know, because I started the rumor. You know, so it was interesting. These things are going on. All in the name of religion. Yeah, so like that. Righteousness. Never turning one's heart to unrighteousness means no matter what the situation, one should always maintain righteousness. Like that. The destruction of the unrighteous. That the unrighteous, even though it appears that they're flourishing, they won't for long. Because if they're flourishing, means there's some good credit from the past. So if there's not so much good credit, then you'll see their destruction at some point. Like that. And if it's more, it may go into, they may live a full life of prosperity, then in their son's life, then you'll see that it will fall apart. And if it's an extremely good amount of good fortune, then you'll see in the grandchild there it'll fall. But that's as far as it can get. So no matter how much piety they have, even though it should have lasted for generations, it will be burnt within three. So you'll see it will fall apart with the grandchildren. So it mentions that men's first, the impious person overcomes his obstacles, then he becomes prosperous, then he conquers his enemies, then he is destroyed branch and root. So that means down everything. So that means the whole family, the whole dynasty is destroyed. So that's why one should stay away from unrighteousness, because it'll affect more than just oneself. You know? Because we do something wrong, it also will affect those who are our dependents. They also will share in it. So one should always be careful. Like you see, it's Duryodhana, his whole family, all his brothers. Only him and Dushasana did anything technically wrong. Like that. And one of them spoke up. But it destroyed all 100. Like that, they were all destroyed. So that's the point. They destroyed everybody. Them and I think all their sons. You know? Because there was no one left from Duryodhana's side to sit on the throne. Right? There wasn't anybody left. Pandavas also nobody left, so it was actually the grandson in Pritikit. He was the only one that was left. Like that. You know, one is Duryodhana because they were sinful. The Pandavas because it's the end of the pastime, so they're winding up and then they go to the forest. Like that. Okay. Yeah. Then always delighting in good conduct. Anyone should always just decide good conduct is what I want to do and then do it and be happy. Like it means whatever you decide is what you want is what makes you happy. So if you decide good conduct is what makes you happy, then you'll be happy. Walking in the path of holy men. So again, we see it's reiterated. So anything constantly said, you'll see is what's important. So here, following the footsteps of the virtuous, respecting the virtuous, being nonviolent by body, mind, and words, like that. not doing anything unrighteous. You see, always again and again. So there's certain principles that are always just coming up, right? And this is morality, right? This is ethics. So this is, does that make some sense? So devotees say that we don't have any ethics, we don't have any morality. We do, we just ignore it, like that. Then bearing offense without resentment, like that. So offenses that come must be borne without resentment, like that. And that here it's, now this is the point where then it talks about, when the Brahmacharya mentioned about the being humble and all that, but here's now where it goes to every relation there is in the family. And why you shouldn't have quarrels with them at this point, you know, and who they represent. If you don't argue with these different things, what you, on the mundane platform, what realms then you gain, like that. You know, the father is Prajapati, so that the Prajapatis are on the higher planets. The mother's then the earth. The mother, I think, and the uncle, maternal uncle, is the earth. Then the, so all this, you have all these different realms like that. So in other words, basically one just has to tolerate like that. That's the main point, you know.
You said mother was the earth. It represents the earth.
Yeah. The potency of the earth is represented the mother and her brothers. Like that. So each family member, there's a part of the universe. So that's the thing, is everything's coming down through the Lord's potency. So all the demigods are reflections of the eternal associates of the Lord. And then those come down into everything that we're here, and so then they come down into the family unit also. Right? So there's always the macro and the micro. It's like an Ayurveda. You have your body. Within your body it's structured like the universe. So if you understand the universe, then you understand how the body works. So the body, you understand the universe. So Ayurvedic doctor can explain how the body functions and cosmology. The same verse they can translate either way. Like that. And because those then have their origin in the philosophy, they can explain through the same verse the philosophy. Like that. So everything has its, you know, in the Vedic literatures, they're also the body, you know, certain parts of the feet, certain parts of the eyes, certain parts of the ears. Like that. So like this, every, you know the one subject, you know the whole thing. So the same way is the family is also a microcosm of what's bigger. You know, that's why what's in Grihastha life, you can then apply it to the universe, and what's in the universe, you can apply it in the family. So that's how there's a smooth transition from attachment to detachment. Detachment means now you look at the universe. Attachment means you just look at the family. Like that. So you can move in and out of them. That's why the Vedic is so nice, because there's a connection between the two. That if you know the connection. So that's the metaphysics. The devotees can understand the religion, you know, but then forget the philosophy, or they can understand the philosophy, forget the religion. And generally both sides can't understand the metaphysics, because it overlaps both. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so how should we relate with them if they are not devotees, in a way which is going to be beneficial and which is not going to entangle us in mundane, mundane reactions?
Basically being pleasant. It doesn't mean you have to agree, just like you see Prahlad Maharaj. He never dealt improperly or unpleasantly with his father. He didn't agree with him. You know, he spoke his mind. But he always did it based on Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra and according to etiquette. So he'd always address him, you know, my dear, best of the demons, you know, like this, that if you do this, then, you know, it's considered that life is wasted. But if you do this, then you get benefit. So he didn't say, you know, you're a nonsense demon, you're going to hell. He didn't say any of that. He just pointed out, Shastra say, if you live like this, you get benefit. You live like that. So, need be, you put it into third person. You know, third person or passive voice. Right? Because passive voice, you hide who's doing it. You just show what's being done to who, but who's doing it you hide. Right? That's the benefit of passive voice. So you can point out to them if someone does this, then this will happen. You're leaving out that they're the ones doing it. You know? Like that. You know, it's said in the vegetarian diet, it's very good for the health, it's very this, that. You don't tell them that they're nonsense for like that. So that's the meaning of what these different voices are for, is for depending on what you're trying to, what's the use, you know, like that. So always when, if you're speaking to somebody, a point, if you use third person, then, you know, one should do this. You don't say, you should do this. As soon as you use the second person on them, then they get uncomfortable. If you use third person, then there's no problem. And if even third person would be a problem for them, then you use third person in passive voice. And then it even becomes more soft. So it becomes easier for them. So that's the purpose of language, is to do this. But one has to know that these are the effects. You know? Like that. Yes. And it's also, that's a tradition, it's called what is it? The Satanga Linga and Panch Anga Nyaya, which means the five points, that you make a point, then you say, others may say. Then you say what they say, how they would present it, that makes looks like there's a contradiction between what you've said. So that's the third point. The fourth point is you resolve their contradiction. It means, in other words, you defeat their points. Then the fifth is then you make the conclusion, which brings it back to the first point that you made. So that's standard. So Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said in the, you know, any valuable discussion functions in this way. That's why you see Krishna's even using it in the Gita. Even though he's God, he's still using Panchanga Nyaya. You see so many chapters, he says, some say this, some say that. You know, some say that, you know, sacrifice is done through the senses, some say it's like this, some say it's like that. So even he's quoting the other authorities, but then pointing it out, but then he says, but in my opinion, it's this. So then he's giving, first he says they say that, then he points out the technicalities of it and why it shouldn't be that, it should be this, and then he concludes it. He just, you know, he'll either just conclude it, and sometimes he makes it really strong, then he says, you know, in my opinion, it's this. So that you wouldn't get any doubt. If it would be a point that's very important, that you might get a doubt and miss the point. Because a lot of times devotees read the chapter, like in Jnana Yoga, the sixth chapter. So that's on the Ashtanga Yoga system. Of it, Vaishnavas are only interested in the last two. You know, Dharana and Jnana and Samadhi. Because the other six, we have our own sadhana how we get. The yogis do it through physical, we do it through our sadhana bhakti. So then devotees actually either reject the whole system because we're not into yoga. So you leave off those higher points, and if you do that, it's a little bit of a problem, because when you get to the Brahma-Bhuta platform, then that's what you got to work with, right? Bhava-Bhakti is performed with Jnana and Samadhi, like that. That's the platform where it functions at. But the lower ones, that's we take care of in our sadhana-bhakti. So then you lose that, or they get right into yoga. So therefore then Krishna will say, in my opinion, that the best of yogis is this. You know, and then when you hear that, then it's like, what's that got to do with yoga? You know, so if you understand the steps he's going through, then you understand that even he uses that, because he's established it, so naturally he'll use it. You know? And then the principle we mentioned here of the Tatparya Lingas is that repetition. You can understand that that's the main theme, because you always want to know what's the main theme or the main themes of any work. So one of them is what is glorified, and one of them is what is repeated. So you know that that's something important in a work, anytime it's glorified, then you know that this is important. Does that make sense? It means even the karmis will use it unknowingly, like that. You know, the person, the hero in the book is being glorified for something. So that means what he's done is actually important to the writer, to the author. Like that. You can understand the value system of the author by these things, what they constantly repeat, what they, you know, like that. You know, jumping chocolate frogs is valuable to the author because they repeat it so many times. You know, like that. So, like that, then you can tell, you know, these things by these methods, like that. So that will come up, you know, after the festival sometime, then the whole process of nyaya or logic, that will be, you know, one of the topics.
What are the five things called?
Panchanga nyaya means the five limbs of logic. I can just say what they do. I can't say the actual Sanskrit names. But the first one is you present your point, the Siddhanta. It means you give your, in other words, it's the thesis. You give your thesis, right? Then there's a doubt, right? That thesis is there. Then there's a doubt in that thesis, right? And that's the second point, that there is a doubt. Yeah, that you just allude that there is a point here. In other words, you've made a point, then they make a point of difference. Right? So then you expand that point of difference. That's the third part. So that's the antithesis. Right? The antithesis. In other words, the first point is your philosophy based on the point. The second part is that they have a question on that they think is inconsistent. The third one is then expanding on that inconsistency to actually explain it, why they say it's what you've said is wrong. Then the fourth is where you explain how they've misunderstood or misapplied, you know, what you've said to come up with their antithesis. So then you correct their antithesis. So then you've cleared the doubt. Then the fifth part is then you reiterate your original point now in a more conclusive way that's all-encompassing, so it includes your point and, you know, shows how their point was not. Means it includes that doubt, you know, but in its corrected form. Does that make sense? So in other words, you start off just presenting a point, but you have to, explore that point. So then generally it's explored through doubts. You know, in other words, through questions. So that's why the Vedic system uses this. It's based on questions. Right? Like that. Modern, they don't like you to question. Right? You ask too many questions. If you question the actual basis of the professor's lecture, he won't appreciate that at all. You ask questions within the realm of what he'd like you to ask questions in, then you're an A student. You doubt that what he's saying has any purpose, then you're an F student. You know? It's like that. So it's not built in. But the Vedic is questioning is the basis. You have to know why it works. So the actual, even, you know, the existence of the principles that you're saying can be questioned. Because if you understand what it's based on and question that, and then that's cleared, then you will be completely situated in that. So you make your point, you know, we are not this body. Okay, so that makes the statement. That's what you're trying to make. And then they'll go, you know, no, but everybody, you know, everybody identifies with the body. You know, and then you point out, you know, this one, he does this because of his body, that one because of that, your body, and his whole identity is his body, so how can you say we're not the body? Then you point out is that there's the conditioned nature and all these things, so you're able to explore deeper your point that you've made through the doubt, because the doubt's a question. It's actually questioning your point, you know. In other words, it's like a very large rhetorical question, but it has its own answer, you know, opposite of what you're saying, but it allows you to explore, right? As soon as there's conflict, then people pay attention, right? Like that. If everybody's agreeing and all that, everyone falls asleep. If there's a conflict, then hey, you know, what's going on? So then immediately, then it's a wonderful way of presenting, as long as you know what you're doing. You know, you don't get overwhelmed by the other point, you know. Because sometimes devotees get into this, they get into the doubt, and then they become convinced by the doubt, and then go away from Krishna consciousness. So then that doubt is there, then you point out all the things. No, you know, because the soul is there, and because the soul is conditioned, therefore it identifies with it, though it's not, so it acts like it, because of having material desire. It wants to be separate from God, so it wants to enjoy like God, so then material world is done, and that desire then manifests in the polluted mind. The mind manifests the senses, the sense manifests the body. Therefore, they're not the body, but it's based on their mundane identity. So now you just redefined their point. Does that make sense? So you've redefined their point, so then you've defeated the thing. They say that because people have identity with it, it is them. But you've pointed out where that identity is from. It's actually their mundane, the desire for mundane enjoyment separate from God. That is the identity. Therefore, all this is created. So you change that identity and you change that. Otherwise, how do you have transcendentalists? You know, then you give your conclusion. Right, that therefore we can ask the spirit soul belongs in the spiritual realm. If they change their identity, they give this up. You know, but that identity can be used in the Lord's service. So then you fully say everything you want to say about it. So in other words, when you're presenting, then either the person is intelligent and has thought of those doubts, so you address them, or they're not that thoughtful and you bring them up yourself to explore your point. And then you bring it back to a conclusion. So then you've cleared the doubts, and so then one is fixed. So that's the method of that's the traditional Vedic method, and that's accepted by Srila Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Like that. So that's method of presentation. That's how you're going to present. Then Tatparyalinga is the form of your presentation. Means your opening and closing statement have to be consistent. You know? What you glorify, what you repeat, like that. Then there's three other points that then make that. That's how you're going to make your original presentation. You know? Or anytime, in other words, in the first, fourth, and fifth parts of Panchanga Linga, that's how you're going to work. So from that, then the person who comes up with the doubt, the second and third part, we'll see that and understand, okay, this is your point. Right? Because otherwise, I don't know if you've had the experiences, is you sit down and you start discussing something, and then another devotee argues with that, and after about 3 hours of slowly, slowly defining your terms and that, you find out the two of you are saying exactly the same thing. Exactly the same thing. No difference, but just you use a word in one way, and for the other person, that's a buzzword that they use in another way. You know, all it is, I've had that happen a couple of times. You know, it's just like, it's so shocking. After 3 hours of yelling and screaming and this and that, you find out you say exactly the same thing. So that's why the Vedic has the system of nyaya, so that everybody from the first word is on the same page. You know, so there's a system how you present, you know, how you make your point and everything, so the other person really knows what you're making. And if need be, they define words. So traditionally they have a set of, I think it's about 100 words, I think in 7 different categories that are defined, and everybody just accepts them, you know, because they're Vedic, like that. And that was established by Vaishyasika. I think Vaishyasika, and then refined into, I think, the school of Gotama. And that, so then there's a basic book, everybody when they start, doesn't matter if they're Vedic, they all study that book. It's the first book of Nyaya. So they all know what you're talking about. When you say sight, what does that mean? When you say tongue, when you say taste, when you say earth, when you say sky, when you say, you know, body or emotion or atom or existence. What does it mean? So they're things that all schools, all the six schools accept. Like that. And so then, base it on that, then everybody knows what you mean when you said it. So that would be the tradition. Otherwise, you find most of the time arguments happen because of semantics over a word. You know, a word that was, you know, perfectly normal word, you know, yesterday, then today becomes the politically incorrect, you know, word, you know. It's just like, you know, before you could say, you know, Brahmins, Vaishya, now it's in politically incorrect, you can't say that. You know, I mean, all these things, they just change with the weather, you know, like that. So the Vedic was, is they didn't bother with what was politically correct, because politically correct meant what the Shastra said. And the Shastra always says the same thing, so there's certain basics everybody who follows the Vedas can agree on. Like that. So then, you know, your Nyaya, your grammar, like that. So between those two, then you could discuss, always. You could guarantee to have an intelligent discussion with another person. What is your conclusion? What is your method? That'll be different. How you identify, you know, applications of those, you know, basic principles. You know, that's what you think the use of the body is for. That's another thing. That's individual. But you can already explain earth, water, fire, air, ether, the six senses, the mind, the intelligence. Like that. So then everybody has the same point there. Does that make some sense? So if there is a difference, then you explain it. Means there are, I think, a couple of words like the soul, they can get some difference of opinion. Because some accept the soul, some don't. So then you say what you mean by soul. You know, if you know that they're the school, then you know they don't accept the soul. So therefore you say this, and then they'll say that. Then you can talk. So it works. It's so these kind of things then are good. And even in your own senses, in speaking, you know if there's a particular thing you want to say, but it's that you define it. Then the person knows what you're talking about. Because if it's undefined, then it's always a big problem. Otherwise, there's all these broad, sweeping generalizations that sound really great, you know, like that. But you have to be able to what does it mean, you know, that everybody should work together or cooperate or have love or what does that mean? You know, everyone should love each other. In the 60s, that meant everybody should have sex with each other. You know, so what is your definition of what this means? Because, you know, everybody, it's sentiment, so everybody just attributes their own desires of their own mind to it. Like that. Does that make sense? Like that? May I finish? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. What is it? Post-Russian meditation, comics, tennis, forest. Okay. Okay. So then next on next Tuesday, then we're going to get to topic 13, laws concerning women. So what we're going to do is before then is that section we're actually going to print out fully so that everybody can go through it, and then we're going to discuss that in full like that. So that's the one thing we'll do is like that. Do that one, and then there's another section. Yeah, but this that'll take a little bit of discussion because charity is something that's there. Lawful and forbidden food won't be much of a problem for us because we're not much into meat eating, so that shouldn't be a difficulty. If you have problems with, you know, how you say, onions, garlic, leeks, and mushrooms, then we might have a little discussion. But other than that, then and purification, topic 12. The 12.3, then there are some things that we deal with, 12.3 and 12.4, but 12.1.2 is, that's very light, because that's purification, means impurity on the birth or death of someone in the family. So for us, it's just very, very mild. So there's not much to discuss there. But for the Karmakandis, it's very, very serious, this section. So for us, this is another one of these sections that basically just gets dropped. You know, it's like the before in the whole thing of where was that? Yeah, the whole topic 8A, 8 and 8A, then for us becomes reduced very greatly. It's a huge section, huge. You know, we did that before. So all that gets reduced. So that section gets reduced. So we should get to topic 13 on Tuesday. And then instead of going through it just here as outline, we'll go through it actually the full text. Like that. Then we'll go to, then we'll finish the ashram, and then we'll go to, I think it's legal business, civil, then we'll go to valid evidence, title 1-2, manner of return, clinical time, stream of batteries, legal time, theft and robbery, bar. Then we'll go to, it means in the contents will be page 168. You know what's on the side? It means the legal title 15, adultery. So actually what it means, because then from that you can tell what is chastity. Like that, because it gets into the subtleties of it there. And then we'll go to discourse 9, domestic concerns, and we'll deal with legal title 16, laws concerning husband and wife. Like that. And so that goes through quite a bit. And then after that we'll go to the easiest thing would be to go to the what we call the bindu, which means the essential verses from the whole thing. Like that. Means instead of going through the whole, because it gets really, really technical. From the seventh chapter, because it's just the whole Kshatriya Dharma, right? You know, very, very technical little points. So then, then we'll go to that, which gives a basically all the essential verses. So it's about 60, on its own, it's probably around a 65, 70 page document, like that. But these points on the women's, specifically the laws regarding the women, we'll print that out separately. So that it doesn't make that essential point bulky. We'll have already gone through it like that. Then we'll go through that one, and then that will give us a very detailed overview of the whole work like that. So then that will be how we'll go through it. Okay. Okay. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Janyatai Gaura Prema Nandini.